The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So welcome to the Critical Geopolitics Today panel. Our panelists are Tony Wood, Craig Barrow, Lorenzo Coro, and Beatriz Marcos. We'll start with Tony Wood and his paper on Russia, the West, and the 21st century, and then go in order. See?
Sure. Great. Okay, thanks. So some of you may have seen a couple of news stories about Russia recently. I think it's a sort of important analytical task, especially when it comes to Russia, although it applies more generally, to kind of resist hyperbole and to resist the sense of this is some momentous, you know, earth-shattering fascist assault on the West that is happening. On the other hand, I do think that since the events of 2013-14 in Ukraine, and especially the Russian intervention in Syria, we do find ourselves on the other side of a fairly major geopolitical watershed. And I'll explain why I think that is in a second. I think that the second part of the talk, I'm going to think about what lies ahead of that watershed, what awaits us. And I'm particularly thinking about this from Russia's point of view. What are Russia's options? What are the constraints operating upon it within this 21st century kind of context? And you know, some of these are fairly speculative options, and this is a very much a kind of trial run, so I'd be interested in people's feedback on those questions. But I do think it's important to recognize that something has finished, and we are in something of a new phase with quite unpredictable consequences. So first of all, what is it that is over? It's the long-standing Russian dream of alliance with or integration with the West. This actually has been a feature of Russian foreign policy, and indeed before it, late Soviet foreign policy, for a very long time. And it's persisted longer into Putin's administrations than people would tend to realize. I won't go into great detail about the successive forms this has taken, but it's a consistent impulse within Russian foreign policy that has just undergone various modifications, but has nonetheless been there. From the Gorbachev era in the mid-1980s, where he talked about a common European home, there what you saw was an impulse towards convergence with the West. And the first half of Yeltsin, you could call it, with the foreign minister being Andrei Kozyrev, it was a different impulse of joining the West on subordinated terms. So slightly very different emphasis. In the second half of the 1990s, there's a third phase under the foreign ministership of Yevgeny Primakov, and then prime ministership briefly, where there's an attempt to stake out an independent position for Russia, so not subordinate integration by any means. And there's a tilt away under Primakov to kind of re-establish better relationships with the Middle East, with former Soviet allies and client states. But nonetheless, the West was still the central point of orientation for Russian policy in that second half of the 90s, so it's still the kind of lodestar, if you like. Putin, when he first came to power, actually represents something of a synthesis of these points of view, in that he is very much seeking integration with the West, but on somewhat more independent, qualities, if you like. Again, this is very hard for people to imagine from the standpoint of now, but in the year 2000, Putin actually asked Clinton if he could join NATO. And there have been consistent desires to form closer links with the EU. Medvedev, during his presidency 2008 to 2012, talked about economic integration to form a common space from Vancouver to Vladivostok. This is a very persistent idea. Medvedev said that, I think, after the Georgian War, so when relations with the West were already entering what has become a steady downward spiral of hostility, but nonetheless, this impulse persisted. I think Ukraine is very much the end point of that impulse. I think there was already, from 2012 onwards, an increasingly assertive nationalism within Russian foreign policy. This is a clear impulse within the new, if you like, the third Putin administration, to forge a kind of new basis for its rule with a kind of stronger chauvinist strand, especially since the economic downturn post 2008-09 meant that it could no longer rely on the kind of pump of oil money to secure a legitimacy for its rule. So this nationalist turn has certain consequences for its orientation to the West. Nonetheless, there's a kind of strange coexistence of impulse to join the West and rejection of the West that persists under Putin and Medvedev, and it's really Ukraine that breaks that, if you like, that unstable synthesis that breaks it apart in Ukraine. I mean, many people probably disagree with me on this point, but I feel like events in Ukraine were a massive strategic defeat for Putin and for Russia. I think the recovery of Crimea is seen as this wonderful patriotic success within Russia domestically, and sold as a major defeat for the West by the Western mainstream press, but I think it's actually very much played into the West's hands. You have a fully pro-Western Ukrainian state, you have sanctions on Russia, total isolation diplomatically, and I think also the one thing to bear in mind is that Russia has exhausted a lot of the options it had relative to the West in terms of drawing a line, pushing a forcible solution. So I think that was a very significant defeat. And I mean, there are many different factors at work in the Russian intervention in Syria, but you have to see it in that context as an attempt to break out of the isolation, reassert a relevance on the world stage, and to somehow make Russia matter to the West once again. And Syria is an opportunity to do that among many other things. But the other aspect in which I want to highlight about Syria now that makes it especially significant is that this is the first really significant out-of-area operation for the Russian military since Afghanistan. There have been peacekeeping missions here and there. A lot of peacekeeping in the immediate surroundings of Russia in the post-Soviet zone, but this is far beyond that. And this is, on some level, an attempt to project power far beyond its traditional kind of zone of influence, if you like. And this is where I think we get into very unpredictable, uncharted territory in terms of what the consequences of that will be. The potential for escalations militarily with the West are certainly significant, especially in a more unpredictable, militarized context. So I think this combination of things that pushes us into a new geopolitical situation. On the one hand, Russia is very much no longer seeing itself as potentially part of the West or potentially joined with the West. It very much now thinks of itself as the non-West. It's possible that this could alter in some way. There could be new kinds of convergences, but I think there's something fundamental has changed. It's changed gradually, but I think now we can definitely see that that is different. So that's Ukraine marks that endpoint, and Syria, on the other hand, marks a sort of new entry point into very much more unpredictable geopolitical situation in terms of the consequences of that non-Western alignment. What does that mean? And in military context, again, as I said, could be very unpredictable. But just sort of stepping back somewhat to think about what the longer-term consequences of this are, I think one of the things that these crises, Ukraine and Syria combined, have posed again is the question of what Russia's position is in the world. I think this is very much unresolved, and likely to be unresolved for some time. The reason for this is that Russia occupies this very uncomfortable position, mid-range position. Perry Anderson referred to it as incommensurate, which I think is a good term, because it's too big to be absorbed into the West, even if it were willing, as it was in the 1990s. On the other hand, it's not big or strong enough to pose a fundamental challenge to the West, even if it wanted to, as it did during Soviet times. And so this intermediate position is reflected across a whole range of positions, not just in the ideological realm, but also in the economic sphere too. Just to sort of throw out some, not actual numbers, but in terms of relative positions, Russia, in terms of per capita GDP, Russia is the richest of the BRICS, which sounds impressive in its own way. It's ahead of Brazil and China, per capita GDP. But one has to bear in mind that this is not that significant, because per capita GDP of Russia is lower than that of Kazakhstan and Turkey, very slightly ahead of Mexico. So we are not talking about a front rank economic power by any means. And again, you get an idea of this when you compare its per capita GDP with that of Portugal, which is currently less than half. Russia's GDP is less than half that of Portugal. This is a notable statistic, parenthetically, because before he came to power, Putin said in 15 years' time, we will overtake the GDP per capita of Portugal. But of course, in the meantime, Portugal has got further ahead, so they've not matched that. And obviously when you compare it to larger powers like Germany, it's still, the gap is still wider. Per capita GDP of Russia is a quarter that of Germany, a quarter that of France. Not bad. In the military sphere also, this is something that people do tend to highlight, that Russia has one of the largest militaries in the world. This is true in manpower terms, but you have to remember this is a largely conscript army. Many of them are teenage boys, they're not as well equipped by any measure as any Western army, any NATO army. They have had a boost in military spending, which is quite significant, and they have rearmed, and unfortunately Syria has been the testing ground for a lot of these weapon systems. But still, its capacities lag very far behind those of the West. US military spending is 10 times that of Russia on 2015 numbers. It's about level with that of the UK in absolute terms, but in per capita terms, Russian military spending is roughly the same as that of Germany or Greece, which again, one doesn't think of as counter-hegemonic powers per se. The military advantages Russia does have, which might make a difference to its strategic calculations in the long term, are firstly its nuclear arsenal, and secondly, a willingness to deploy force very quickly and decisively, as it did in eastern Ukraine, Crimea, Syria. This is cited as some kind of advantage, but I wouldn't actually argue against that being any kind of advantage that could be relied on, because by its nature, that kind of advantage is one of tactical maneuver. The speed of military maneuver is not something that can be built into a permanent advantage at all. And it comes at a very significant cost. It builds in the expectation that Russia will act quickly militarily, which obviously can lead to a ratcheting of tensions among other powers, nuclear arms build-up, other kinds of conventional arms build-up. So I think actually that, in fact, the combination of Ukraine and Syria may have already exhausted that military advantage for Russia. All of which adds up to the fact that Russia has this long-standing desire to be an independent power, which may be possible, but it certainly can't do it as a great power. And I think that tension between being independent and being great is where we can locate the Russian dilemma in the 21st century. I just wanted to lay out a few options that present themselves to Russia, and then think about the constraints. The options I'm thinking about all really reflect this intermediate position that it occupies. Intermediate both in terms of rank in economic power, in military weight, but also intermediate in terms of geographical position. Sort of poised between Europe and China, also the US, geographically speaking, it has this very clear intermediate position, and so the question then becomes what functions follow from that, what roles are possible within that context. And what I've sort of thought of really, that the options could be grouped under three kinds of metaphor, if you like. One of which is a sort of strategic metaphor, if you like, of a pivot, that Russia could be a makeweight on kind of the global geopolitical scale, that it could be a swing power. Is one term that has been used by some foreign policy thinkers in Russia, that in other words, it could balance with either the US or China against the other power, or it could form a coalition of other powers to balance against either the US or China. But that Russia has the weight to swing behind a collection of other powers, but not sufficient to form a pole on its own. That's one scenario. Another scenario would be to sort of look at Russia's position as and try and make a virtue of its location as a kind of corridor or a connection between the West and China. And there are positive and negative versions of this. There's a pessimistic version which some of you may have heard of, the novelist Vladimir Sorokin, who's wrote a dystopian fiction set in 2028, where Russia is just this sort of effectively a transmission belt, which is, you know, a pipeline or a giant motorway shipping stuff back and forth between West. That's the kind of bleak variant, which is a subordinate incorporation, or just, you know, emptying out of its function to the West and China. But you could have a more optimistic version of that, where it would be integrated with but independent of China and the West in some form. That's a sort of more economistic version, the kind of corridor connection idea. And the third metaphor that occurs to me is sort of back in the geopolitical frame, really, it's that of a buffer. So rather than Russia being an active participant in geopolitical struggles, balancing with or against particular powers, that it would actually act as a buffer between rival power blocks. And this might involve some kind of declaration of neutrality or some kind of more active push for peace, which seems completely implausible, I agree, in the current context. That's not what the current Russian regime would be about. But thinking in very long terms, if the military advantages Russia might have are set to dwindle and disappear, then the attraction for Russia of being the kind of central pole of a kind of, if you like, reconfigured non-aligned movement might be interesting to think about. But again, that's a very speculative possibility. So those are sort of three kind of metaphorical scenarios, if you like. Much easier to imagine, of course, are the constraints within which Russia will be operating. And I've grouped these myself under kind of four or five headings. Firstly, there's the economic constraint of the... Great, thank you. Its increasing dependence on natural resource exports. Currently, 80% of exports formed by hydrocarbons, metals, minerals, that kind of thing, which has deepened since the late Soviet period, and this is a sort of augmenting trend. And it faces a real problem of how to diversify the economy. So that is a very active constraint on reshaping its economy, and therefore its role within the International Division of Labour, of course. A second related constraint is demographic. As is well known, Russia's population is shrinking more rapidly than that of other advanced industrial countries. It's due to go down from 140 million now to 110 million by the end of the century. And so one has to, and concomitant with that is also an aging of the population, so a decline in the labor force is very significant. And again, that constrains the kind of economic options, even if you could diversify and have a much more dynamic economy, would you have the personnel able to do that and realize quality gains and so forth? Related to the population shrinkage question is one to do with the demographic makeup of the country itself. In an optimistic scenario where Russia manages to keep the population level, the main way of doing that is through massive influx of migrants. And again, to keep the population level by the mid-century, something like more than a third of the population would have to be migrants who would overwhelmingly, in the Russian case, come from Central Asia. And this is, you know, currently the source of xenophobic tensions within Russia, especially given the kind of Putin regime's chauvinistic push. So there's an increasing tension between the national self-assertion of Russia as a power within this context and the demographic makeup it will have to sustain that, the basis of its power. And I see these unfolding in attention with the territorial constitutional framework of Russia, which is already, again, a halfway house between an empire, the Tsarist Empire, and a kind of decolonized, more fragmented space. And it's sustained through this kind of pseudo-federal compact. But the demographic shifts will have to keep reposing that question, I think, and that's another potential constraint that it faces. How am I doing?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay, I've got two constraints to go, great. There's an external constraint, obviously, which I won't go into in any great depth, but that's the evolution of the international system. And there's an open question of how long we have a unipolar system as opposed to, the famous Chimerica, the dual domination by US and China, or some more open-ended multipolar world. But I think we're quite far from that still, and I think we've got a large chunk of the 21st century with unipolar dominance to go, during which Russia's actions will be largely constrained by what the West does in response or in advance of those actions. So I think the West will, to a large extent, shape what Russia becomes with its own actions, and that's something to think about. So I've listed three internal constraints, if you like, the economic, the demographic, and the national question, and the external constraint of the international system. But I think the place where all of these things meet is in the fate of the actual current regime in Russia, that all of these things will come to bear from different directions on the Putin regime, which seems somewhat insulated from challenges domestically in any serious form that would topple it. I think there are various forms of mobilization that have been happening, but have not yet seemed to pose a fundamental challenge to the whole system of power. So it seems likely that one could bet on the continuity of the current system, at least for another Putin administration. But on the other hand, I think it seems unwise to bet on things with any confidence in Russia, given the speed with which the USSR itself unraveled and the Romanov Empire 100 years before that. Thank you.
The next paper is by Kai Garrow, Globalization Theory and State Theory, with Paul Zeitman.
Thank you. This is a very theoretical paper. I don't know that I'm really going to be talking about geopolitics that much, but we'll be talking about globalization theory and state theory. And this is a problem that's been bothering me for a while, but what finally set this off is, I don't know if you've seen that there was a textbook that was just recently published by Manfred Steger and Amitabh Walrup called What is Global Studies? And I was originally asked to review that book, and when I reviewed the draft manuscript, I essentially had three criticisms, which I suggested at the time, if you don't correct these problems, there will be a lot of criticism of your book as a consequence of your failure to correct these problems. And this is it. The first was, of course, the failure to sort of acknowledge and even recognize that there were a lot of subterranean anti-globalization tendencies already at work in the United States and Western Europe, and these were just sort of not discounted, just completely ignored. A second problem that I saw was sort of really misrepresenting what I saw as international relations theory and using it sort of as a straw man and a whipping post to construct their own kind of independent, what they called moderate globalizing position. And then the third, of course, was just a complete failure to acknowledge the whole set of neo-Marxist political economy that had been working on these issues for at least 20, if not 30 years. Really not a footnote, not a reference, not a mention of a name, and this on top of the fact that we had just recently seen the publication of Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin's The Making of Global Capitalism, which really represents the kind of work I would be pushing peoples toward. So in sum, those are sort of the three things that I'll be talking about, and in many ways as a consequence, the paper's initially set up as a critique of globalization theory, particularly as it's been developed over the last two decades by Manfred Steger, who I think probably done as much as anyone, if not more than most people, to sort of establish an independent, separate field of global studies. Now, why is that important? Well, I start with the concept of globalization and how it emerges and sort of the theory behind it. I don't know if anybody can see this. We didn't have a PowerPoint here, but if you're familiar with Google Ngram, I love to do these things as a political theorist, because what it does is allow you to track the usage of concepts, ideas, and names going back to 1880 in books in all kinds of languages. This is in the English language. Now, I don't know if you can see this, but if you use a term like capitalist state and theory of the state, it sort of peaks out in 1980, right after the end of the Miliband Palatsas debate. And then about 87, 88, when Susan Strange publishes her book, The Restraint of the State, you can see the term globalization just skyrockets. Looks like the stock market in 1990s just goes off the charts. And correspondingly, uses of terms relevant to the state or the capital state just sort of go on a downhill. And globalization theory is not the only reason. Postmodernism and its emergence was part of that at the same time. But certainly one of the things you see is that there is just no place for a theory of the state in globalization theory as it was developed during the 1990s. And so I start with the idea that the 1990s was really the decade when globalization becomes the buzzword. And just to give you a few examples, Susan Strange writes, she declares, "The impersonal forces of world markets integrated over the post-war period more by private enterprise and finance industry and trade than by cooperative decisions of governments are now more powerful than the states to whom ultimate political authority over society and economy is supposed to belong. Kenichi Ohmae concluded that because global markets work just fine on their own, nation states no longer have to play a market-making role, and if allowed, global solutions will flow to where they are needed without the intervention of nation states. And even Manuel Castells argued that, quote, state control over space and time is increasingly bypassed by global flows of capital, goods, services, technology, communication, and information. Arjun Appadurai writes, the nation state as a complex political form is on its last legs. And the titles of the books coming out at that time were, of course, The Twilight of Sovereignty, The Decline of the State, The End of the State, and the list just sort of goes on. I even cited myself from Critical Theories of the State, where fortunately, just before it went to the publisher, I added a comma and a clause at the end of the that we could well be witnessing the disintegration of the state as a form of institutionalized political authority, at least as it has heretofore been understood in the modern era. So I sort of gave myself a little wiggle room there, fortunately. But anyway, that's sort of the idea. And of course, in its popular form, you get Thomas Friedman's The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which is that globalization is this inexorable, technologically driven process. It's being driven by communications, by changes in production, technology, and it's unstoppable. And just as well that it's unstoppable because it's such a wonderful thing. We're bringing liberty and freedom of choice to everyone in the world. Standards of living across the globe are improving. Trade flows are improving. So why would you want to stop this? And in that scenario, of course, the state becomes utterly irrelevant. There's nothing the state can do about it except sort of facilitate it or acknowledge it and not get in its way. And of course, the other side of that politically is that, of course, everyone is subordinate to this new global market and have to adopt neoliberal policies that enable them to participate in this global market. Now, the counter to that, of course, was Michael Vesa's book on Globaloney, now out as Globaloney 2.0. Which essentially makes exactly the opposite argument. It's all nonsense, there's nothing to this, nothing has really changed. And then by the end of the 1990s, what you really get is this very polarized position of globalization is inexorable, it's unstoppable, and globalization is globaloney, there's nothing to it. But under either of those scenarios, the globalization theorists that win that debate initially anyway, there's just no place for the state. The state has become utterly irrelevant, and as I mentioned, the titles of their books signify that, the decline of the state, the retreat of the state, all of which I think is misrepresents what's actually going on. Now, as we sort of move through that, I think this concept is important because it's really this concept of globalization that has become increasingly institutionalized in this new interdisciplinary field of global studies. And you're starting to see global studies sort of assert itself in the establishment of new university courses. We just added a required one. Programs, departments, degrees, research institutes, all devoted to the study of globalization, globalism, and have really begun to gain traction in university programs, I think, through the publication of textbooks. I mean, that's when you sort of know it's become an institutionalized field, is when you need a textbook to teach the course. And I think it's important that Steger and Walrub actually now have sort of written their own textbook to kind of define what this field is. And when you look at this, like any textbook, I think what they try to do is comprehensively define a field of global studies. But I think all of these textbooks, this one in particular by Walrub and Steger, really also contain some hidden methodological presuppositions, their conclusions submerged about globalization and the nation state that I think define their basic position on the issue. And I think I'll use their definition and then my definition just to kind of indicate where I think the difference is and where I think we should be going with this theoretically. And if you look at the other textbooks, by the way, they all adopt Steger's definition of globalization that he gave starting back around 2003. And that definition is that globalization is a set of social processes that appear to transform our present social conditions of nationality into one of globality. And globality, according to Steger, is a social condition characterized by tight global economic, political, cultural, environmental connections and flows that make most of the currently existing boundaries and borders irrelevant. So in other words, the state is just defined out, or at least the nation state is just sort of defined out of this definition of globalization. And as I'm going to argue, when you look at the theory of globalization they're trying to establish, the problem that Stager and Walrup confront is that, first of all, they want to reject what they call the hyper-globalizationist positions of the original globalization theorists, this sort of notion of a technological determinism that is driven by technology. On the other hand, they also very explicitly reject people who try to use the state or explain globalization in terms of the initiatives and policies of states and state actors. Well, if it's not economics that's driving the process of globalization, and it's not politics in the state that's driving the process of globalization, what is? And you get one of two answers depending on which passage you read in their book. One is that they don't have an explanation. It's just this sort of independent processes that all sort of fortuitously happen to all come together at the same time in the same place to create this thing called globalization, that it's sort of a random occurrence. Or I think what you more frequently find hidden in their writings is this notion of globality, which is the final endpoint to which we are trending, where they talk about the displacement of the state and its replacement with new undefined postmodern forms of transnational or global governance. And if you look closely, what you really have here is sort of Hegel's absolute idea, is that globalization is driven forward as a teleological process because it wants to reach this final endpoint called globality. And it really becomes this retreat to philosophical idealism. And actually, when I put that to Stager directly, he said, yeah, we're Hegelians. So there you have it. Now, on the other side, I would suggest that globalization has become a concept that's really been used as a sledgehammer against theories of the state. Because what is the state? Well, most political scientists define the state as an organization that seeks to extend coercive control and political authority over particular territories and the people residing within them. If you'll recall, the globalization of definition of globalization is exactly the opposite of that. So in that sense, you've created this antinomy that there's either globalization or there's state theory. You can't have both, and as a consequence, we'll simply define the state out of existence, at least at some indeterminate point in the future, when postmodern forms of global governance take over. And therefore, all of this other writing that's been done, particularly the neo-Marxist work on political economy, we just won't have to deal with because it's all gibberish. It's not relevant. They just don't get it, would be their view. On the other hand, what do you do with IR theory? And I'll come to that in just a minute. So we have this, what I call, false antinomy between state theory and globalization theory. And what I propose is an approach to globalization that defines it as a policy process, that it's not an inexorable, technologically determined event, but that it is a set of policies that are initiated and pursued over the long term by nation states, and that one of the best examples of that on sort of a grand scale that we've seen recently is Panitch and Gidman's The Making of Global Capitalism, in which they talk about the development of the global world order of global capitalism over about a 70-year period, starting with Bretton Woods right after World War II, and step by step trace that process out as a series of policy initiatives led primarily by the United States, to a lesser degree by Britain, and sort of superintended and overseen by the United States to create what he calls an informal empire. Now, why do they not like that? Well, Stager, for example, as I already talked about, tries to carve out a position that he calls moderate globalizers, or moderate. And so if you sort of line this up, you have what he calls the hyper-globalizers, which the early thinkers like Susan Strange, Thomas Friedman in the late 80s and early 1990s. You have the what he calls the globalization rejectionists, which would be like Michael Zeff and the Globaloney school of thought. And then he faces the problem, well, of what do you do with international relations theory? Particularly realism, neoliberalism, and to a lesser degree, constructivist theory, who all talk about the state and the continued relevance of the state, who still see it as the primary actor in the field of international relations, And there he refers to them as globalization skeptics. And there's one other header. As globalization skeptics. Now, what's wrong with that? Here's one where he talks actually about the concept of globalization is by definition, and this is a quote, beyond the framework of the nation. In fact, they go on to say that, to be sure, some global studies scholars are located on the extreme. They reject the hyper-globalization theorists. Where is it? Well, now, what's the problem here? Well, I would say internally there's a problem, but there's a bigger problem. Internally, if you go back and look at some of Steger's work on globalization, I would suggest that where they run into their problem is when you stop talking theoretical categories and start doing historical, institutional, or empirical research. And to give you an example, in his book on globalization, A Very Short Introduction, which I know has sold tens of thousands of copies, he actually traces the origins of globalization to the Bretton Woods Conference, the same place that Panish and Jindan start in their analysis. And he actually says, to quote, under the leadership of the United States of America and Great Britain, the major economic powers of the global north reversed their protectionist policies of the interwar period. In addition to arriving at a firm commitment to expand international trade, the participants of the conference also agreed to establish binding rules on economic activities and so forth and so on. And so if you sort of trace out this historical analysis, what you get is globalization begins with the Bretton Woods Conference. It extends through the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the creation of the International Monetary Fund, the what later becomes the World Bank, all of which were initiated as cooperative agreements among nation states, led primarily by the U.S. state, and in fact were voting powers within those states, as IR theorists, within those organizations, typically is organized on the basis of the power of the economies of nation states and the contribution to these organizations, and all of which sort of feeds back into this. So what I argue is that if you sort of read through Walrib and Steger's notion of globalization, it either feeds into a historical account of globalization where the nation state appears to be the major international actor in economic, military, and political affairs, or not wanting to go in that direction for reasons that I just really don't understand, end up retreating back into this kind of idealist version of globality as the driver of globalization as a process, if it's not just going to be something random. Now, running short on time, but what I will do is I go through this and sort of I do a sort of an analysis of some IR theorists and say I don't think they really should be called skeptics simply because they continue to argue the importance of the state. But I think the shortcoming in that traditional mainstream IR theory, of course, is it doesn't have a theory of capitalist development. It really doesn't explain the role of states within this process of globalization. They really just talk about their role in constructing international institutions, supranational institutions, and they have some debates among themselves as to how important those institutions are. Mearsheimer doesn't think they're important. Keating thinks they're important. And I won't go through all those debates, but then what I argue is the shortcomings of IR theory take you to the need for theory of global economic development and a theory of the state where the state continues to act as the guarantor of the political and legal and material conditions for global capital accumulation. And I think Panish and Gindan give us a really good start with that. Now, since I don't have time to go through all that, I will just come to a conclusion here, which is where do we end up with all this? Panish and Gindan's book came out in 2012. So it came out just as we were sort of emerging from the Great Recession and the global economic crisis, but before Brexit and Donald Trump. And however, they did leave us with sort of an interesting observation at that time, where they argued that in fact sort of the lines of cleavage that had been sort of created by this globalization process now ran within states rather than between states. And that these were increasingly starting to look very similar from one state to another, and that what it perhaps signified was not a crisis of the state, but a crisis of globalization. And they don't really talk much about it because it was really just getting started. And I sort of draw on an essay by Nicole Ashoff, which came out in Jacobin very recently, to point out that Trump has really thumbed his nose at the keystones of American hegemony, both free trade agreements and the military alliances that underpin U.S.-led capitalism. And so it raises the question of where are we and where are we going on a global scale? What happens if the United Kingdom and the United States, who have really sort of been the guarantors of global capital accumulation, withdraw from this process? That we're starting, are we seeing a crisis of global capitalism? And I think Ashoff is on the right track here by saying that this may signal a crisis of neoliberal capitalism, but not a crisis of capitalism, that what we may be seeing is the emergence of a very different and ugly form of capitalism, and we've heard a lot about that at this conference, in which we're going to see an intensification of domestic conflict in the globalizing metropolises, and that what we may be seeing then is the decline of globalization instead of the decline of the state.
On the origins of authoritarian neoliberalism in Latin America, rethinking the development of underdevelopment and modernity in the past.
Well, okay. Thank you very much for being here. And so in times of crisis as the one we are witnessing now, where we are witnessing also the passage from the economic to the political, there is an important debate on how states are operating, no? And the way in which the ruling classes are maybe reorganizing the way in which they exercise and maintain power, no? Over subaltern classes. Within this debate, an important concept that came up is the one of authoritarian neoliberalism, no? That, I don't know, for example, Ayn Rand applies to Europe, Adam Fabry to Eastern Europe, etc. And an important characteristic of this concept is that we are witnessing the passage from the sort of normal exercise of hegemony in Gramscian terms, where we have integration and participation of citizens, you know, in the reproduction of the system, towards an exercise of power which is more typified by marginalization and exclusion. No? Now, how far this is the best way to characterize the contemporary situation is, of course, a matter of debate. Yet reflecting, no, on this assertion that we are witnessing a period in which marginalization and coercion become more and more important, and looking at it from the perspective of Latin America, we might say that this is not something that is particularly new. No, we can think about the coup d'etat in Chile, which is not an exception. No, it's just it's one element of a bigger pool. No, where neoliberalism, as Abelardo Mariña Flores Arias reached Latin America by the use of the whip, no? So we might mention other dictatorships, no? Like in Brazil, in Bolivia, Argentina, Uruguay, etc. No? Interestingly, if we follow the famous article by our book by Guillermo O'Donnell on this period, he calls it, Guillermo O'Donnell calls it bureaucratic authoritarianism, no? And here, the different literature that discusses his book, etc., agrees that also that this period is characterized, or that authoritarian liberalism is, bureaucratic authoritarianism is characterized by these processes of domination and exclusion. And by the way, many authors also concur in the fact that it is exactly exclusion and domination in this form that differentiates these sort of regimes from fascism, which was, according to Gramsci and the reading that Frosini gives of Gramsci, far more inclusive. Now, In our paper, we want to argue that this form of exercising power that includes domination, exclusion, and so on, is not something that concerns this tragic period of Latin American history, but rather that it is something that is persistent in the in colonial times, but also after the formation after independence and the formation of national states, and that really reaches our period. And this is something that my colleague Beatrice Marco will going to be analyzing in the second part of the paper, talking about the origins of this specific political ratio coming already from Spain during the 16th century, and then being exported to Latin America. At the same time, we are not doing just an idealistic analysis based just on the history of ideas and so on, using alla Benedetto Croce, perhaps, using also Gramsci's concept of historic block. We are, of course, looking at how the structure and the superstructure are interrelated, no? And our idea is that the particular dependent position of Latin American countries within the world economy called for a specific form of government, mm-hmm. exactly characterized by domination and exclusion. By emphasizing that we are talking about specific state, specific capitalist state with specific feature also in Latin America, we are of course rejecting the idea that modernity or capitalism never reached Latin America. This is something that it's important to emphasize. So in my in the next 5 minutes or so, I will have to be very quick. I'm speaking about issues related to underdevelopment and dependency, whilst Beatrice Marco is going to look at the origins of this of the superstructures, no, or of this sort of characteristic of the superstructures in Latin American nations. When talking about dependency, what I'm trying to do is to offer a friendly critique, or you know, to complement major theories that attempted to theorize underdevelopment and dependency. And of course, well, one is dependency theory, and the other is, I guess, political Marxism. And I'm doing that, I'm offering this critique going back to Marx's general law of capitalist accumulation. This is what I'm attempting to do. What I share with, or we share with dependency theory is, of course, the idea that underdevelopment is not something that stands outside capitalism or that comes before capitalism, but it's a structural element of capitalist development. No? It's the other side of the coin. Of course, when I speak about dependency theory, I don't have time to go into that now. You have different strands, etc. I'm rather looking at the radical strand, no? Marini, Dos Santos, and Gunder Frank. Now, if we if we look at how they ultimately analyze underdevelopment, I guess that we can see that the common root is to analyze it as a consequence of the transfer of surplus. Of course, it's articulated in different ways. I cannot explain it here, but that's the main theme, no? The transfer from peripheral countries to the countries of the center. First around processes of primitive accumulation, and then later perpetuated by processes of unequal exchange. Of course, this theory has been criticized at times, not that fairly, perhaps because it was more related to Gunder Frank's works without taking into account the whole tradition of dependency. But the main critique has been the fact that they were focusing on understanding capitalism in terms of exchange and not looking enough at production, that they have an mercantilist understanding of the capitalist world economy, that we have exploitation amongst nations and not classes, that it's static. And what I want to address a little bit slightly more is this question of an equal exchange, because the idea that they put forward, I mean, if you look at the models of an equal exchange, transfer of surplus, Of course, you have this idea that everybody is employed and working, no? So you work, and part of it, because of differences in productivity or in wages, is transferred to the north, no? And this I will show is something problematic. Now, if we look at how Brenner, who is part of this critique of dependency theory, looks at it, there we have the idea that you have underdevelopment because of a lack of capitalist relations of production. No? You have underdevelopment because Latin America didn't witness certain class struggles that led to the establishment of capitalist relations of production. And because it's only when you have the establishment of capitalist relations of production that you can have you must develop the forces of production, and hence you have development. Now, if we look at Latin American history, we might say that maybe Brenner might be right, at least at a superficial level, up to the mid-19th century, end of the 19th century, where indeed Latin America is characterized by pre-capitalist relations of production. Even shortly after, or after independence, you continue to have coercive labor and so on. No? But it's interesting that this changes. No, you have after independence, you have modern states and pre-capitalist relations of production, but then you have a very strong intervention of the state that transforms the relations of production into capitalist relations of production. So what we have finally is capitalist relations of production and underdevelopment, no? Which I guess is which shows us that how problematic Brenner's approach is on that. Now, coming back to Marx's general law, I think that going back to Marx's general law might offer a way of going beyond the problematics I have briefly identified into these two theories, no? And I want to 2 minutes, yeah. I make a very short methodological point, which is that we should understand the general law in global terms, no? Marx, in my opinion, is not looking at a single national state, he's looking at the world economy in general. Mm-hmm. It's at an abstract level of analysis, no? And of course there we have exactly this idea coming from dependency theory, or that dependency theory will also underline that capitalism on the one hand creates wealth, but on the other hand also creates poverty, no? And Marx, I don't have much time to go into that, but Marx of course explains it in the different sections of his chapter, no? on the general law. First, by arguing that capitalist development or accumulation is accompanied by a rise of the proletariat, but then looking at the rise of the composition of capital, he also argues that not all the proletarian thus produced is actually integrated directly in production. Also, a big chunk thereof stays outside capitalist accumulation. And it is in this way that I look at the conditions of Latin America, no? Of representing the reserve army of labor, no? in its different forms, but also of the lumpen proletariat, which is also part of the proletariat and is not integrated into production. No? Going just back to dependency, I attempt to show that we can understand dependent country as country which lack autonomy, whilst strong powers or great powers are characterized by what following Gramsci I refer to as relative geopolitical autonomy. Now, countries are not only integrated, or the economies of subordinated countries are not only integrated in the circuit of capital of dominant countries, but also there are dominant countries use their position also to shift the different contradictions, like poverty, for example, or ecological problems and further contradictions that arise within the capitalist mode of production towards the periphery. It also enables me, well, it enables to do much more, but I didn't have time, also enables me to show how this question of marginalization is crucial, and how this call for a specific form of state whose origins Beatriz Marco is now going to expand on.
Well, thank you, Lorenzo, and first we would like to say thank you for the invitation and to all of you for being here. And also I would like to deeply apologize for my English and for this idiomatic limitation I'm going to read my intervention, sorry also for that. Okay, as my colleague has already told in the introduction of the speech, a logic of exclusion is an inherent feature of Latin American states. And I will try to explain here that this ratio of exclusion was something historically intrinsic to the conformation of Latin America since the early modernity. From the perspective from the political philosophy and history of ideas, that's my field, and as an exercise of critical genealogy of modernity, my intervention will analyze diachronically, as a vehicle for understanding the present, some characteristics of the implementation of practices of power in Latin America. Basically, I will speak about how exclusion became the core of a particular political ratio. In other words, I will outline that exclusion became constitutive of the political praxis and the design of the state, firstly in Spain from the 15th century and subsequently, how this model got exported to Latin America during the colonial period and got reproduced until nowadays. I will structure my analysis around three main points. Firstly, I will talk about that we may call Modernidad del Sur, Southern Modernity, or Hispanic Modernity. I reject the idea that in Spain and the territories of Latin America, modernity never arrived. The reductionist, racist, and paternal explanation that says that modernity never was developed in the Hispanic world hides an unequivocal vision of modernity and the assumption of its superiority. Modernity arrived indeed to Spain and to Latin America, but with its particularities. Secondly, I will outline the marginalization of Spanish republicanism in the classic sense of republicanism, and the imposition of a political ratio of exclusion and domination that eventually got exported to Latin America. I try to make visible the origins of some of these specificities of Spanish modernity with respect to both political practices and relation of people with the state. Political particularities which causes are to be identified in the political implementation of modernity in the so-called Mundo Hispanico. The point that I want to highlight is that some aspects of the political ratio that become prevalent in Castile during the 15th century, a ratio of exclusion and domination, still operate today in Latin America and is in the core of the design of Latin American national states. And thirdly, I will mention the consequences of the imposition of this ratio of exclusion and domination, consequences that implied concerning to the people a defective introjection of the notion of citizenship, a self-inhibition in participation within institutionality, and a lack of trust towards the state. The state is hence perceived as a distant and coercive dispositive, but not as a warrantor of rights and harmonious coexistence. The state is seen as an apparatus allowed to administrate and to legitimate exclusion, and its circumstance of exclusion implies the impossibility of conforming a community that could become a political community through the state. So, only not yet co-opted social movements outside the state can therefore achieve a political community. The consequences of this ratio of exclusion and domination concerning the state is mainly its impunity and arbitrariness in the exercise of dominations, because ruling groups assume that there is not a population empowered as citizenship that is going to interpolate them. Okay. And now, getting back to the first point about Southern modernity, just saying that it has been repeatedly questioned in the field of the history of ideas if the rise of modernity occurred in the Iberian Peninsula at the same time that when it happened in the rest of Europe. It would seem that in the Hispanic world, modernity has never come to light. However, it should be noted that is that not that modernity did not arrive to Austral Europe or that it arrived later. Rather, it was implemented with its own specificities. As Carlos Thibault explained, we may call Modernidad del Sur. It has its own intrinsic characteristics in philosophical, religious, social, political aspects, and also in the conformation of subjectivities. Bolívar Echevarría, for his part, denominates modernidad barroca, baroque modernity. I start from the idea that there are multiple modernities in Eisenstadt's words. Therefore, it's not that modernity did not exist, but rather its narrative has been confined to in an univocal reading of what modernity, proper modernity, means. The plurality of modernity's implementation has been reduced to a standard and univocal lecture of what modernity is, the Northern Europe modernity patented as liberal, white, Cartesian, and Protestant, etc. The Iberian modernity did not fit on the foundational and normative project of Renaissance Europe. Not only did not fit, but it was one of its necessary dialectal residues resulting from the known contradictions in the very core of its official modernity. When I speak of this forgotten Southern modernity in relation with the official modernity, I apply the colonial methodology not only to the usual geographical areas, but to Europe itself and to Spain itself. Northern Europe imposed a cultural and material subordination to Southern Europe in addition to an epistemic silencing. And also, in a sinister fold, Spain reproduced this epistemicide within itself. I take this word from Bonaventura Sousa, epistemicide. Maybe Spain did that in an effort to not to be in turn rejected by the North because of its hybrid nature, I mean the Arab Semitic nature of Spain against the Christian Europe. Okay, and well, with this pass to the second point, there was about marginalization of Spanish republicanism and the imposition of a political rate of exclusion and domination that eventually got exported to Latin America. It was this internal epistemicide that accompanied the conformation of Spanish modernity, simplifying via Islamophobia and Judeophobia, antisemitism, the univocal official Spanish identity tried to be consolidated. The conflict over identity appears as a central problem of Spanish political philosophy, but of course it's a problem that could not be solved by imposing a collective identity through exclusion. Moreover, in the case of Castile, it's very problematic because precisely the most renewal political ideas came from the Arab Semitic and converso humanist thinkers, who besides have lived in its first person the harm experience of exclusion, and so reactively had elaborated political ethos grounded in the notion of inclusion. But instead, a political race of exclusion and domination got imposed. In a coup of tragic irony, for Castile, this self-epistemicide also involved the marginalization and liquidation of a political project. I'm referring to the political project and the so political theology of the Castilian humanist thinkers, mainly the converso marranos, from Alonso de Cartagena to Espinosa. For example, the political project of these humanists articulate ideas of classic republicanism, like participation in the vivere civile, common benefit, public service, limitation of the arbitrary use powers, parliamentarism, etc. It combines that with theological ideas, like universalism and cohesion of the Pauline theology. Presenting through this articulation between theology and republicanism a suggestive understanding of political theology understood from as a form of inclusion. But instead, what got imposed is a political rate of exclusion that conformed a forced official identity, but not a political community. In order to make this possible, it was necessary to consolidate a legal apparatus that legitimate exclusion. I'm talking about the activation of segregationist laws of clean blood in the 15th century in Spain, but not before a solid intellectual resistance by the political humanists. And according to these laws, it was not possible to hold any public position or access to superior education, amongst other restrictions, for someone with Jewish or Muslim ancestors, even if this person was already converted to Christianity. For these persons, the chance of public participation has been ripped off. So the inclusive and republican political project of these converso humanists was marginalized, not least through the violent repression on the the Comunera Revolution of 1521 that we can already describe as a modern revolution. A political regime based on exclusion and domination was imposed, enabling to rise of absolutism. A political regime of exclusion and domination that was a consequence of the marginalization or liquidation of this republican political project and political theology advocated by Castilianum and Stingers. This regime of exclusion is intimately connected with the design of modern Spanish state. Its colonial politics and ultimately in the design of the Latin America states after independence. While in most instances formally eliminated de facto, this rate of exclusion remains characteristic of contemporary Latin American states. The mechanism of participation was strict. So the conception of a nation state in Spanish modernity was not designed as a collective project. As Harry Kamen or Perry Anderson have demonstrated, in fact, Spanish absolutism was weaker than other European countries in the aspect of the effective power of the king, but it was very strong in a symbolic range thanks to the notion of exclusion. For his part, José Luis Villacañas explained that the nation project was built from the beginning, making impossible the consolidation of a political community. This reality led to the detriment of an hegemonic project of liberalism as happened in North Europe under the self-assumed chimera of citizenship and participation. This liberal project was able to inoculate to the people the illusion of being a part of a common political project. But nevertheless, it should be clarified that liberal modernity from the northern countries does not represent an Arcadia of inclusion and participation. However, it is true that the rhetoric of power skillfully made a discourse of invitation to citizenship, an invitation to a collective construction of orthodoxy. While maybe only as an hegemonic strategy, but in the design of the state, the creation of political community that interact at the state was part of the normative project. And so the real exclusion that in fact happened there, in the liberal countries, could be seen as a contradiction of its own normativity. Of liberalism itself. As we have seen over the last centuries, the North European and Anglo-Saxon liberalism was not a true republicanism, the classic meaning of this term, as developed in political philosophy. Despite appropriating of in an exclusivist mode this merit and this label, supported by an entire scholarly apparatus which has provided an anachronistic, partial, and nearly sacred narrative of liberalism, even pro-British thinkers as Hannah Arendt, Baron, Skinner, etc. Liberalism of the Western Europe was not a real republicanism. It did not achieve effective representation, social justice, or real participation, and provoked an underside of underdevelopment and coloniality in the peripheries. Liberal capitalism development was only possible in its own residues, the South, the Gumen, the racialized people, etc. Well, anyway, Anyway, returning to Castile and early modernity, the crucial point is that exclusion was legitimate and justified morally, legally, theologically, in the division of labor, in the distribution of goods, in every aspect. And it was also coercively applied. And thus, exclusion could become a pattern of government, a ratio of government, and people introjected it. People interiorized that state could administrate who can and who cannot enter in the category of citizenship. The impact of this ratio of exclusion is as something constitutive of the state project has been very deep, not only from Spain, but also from Latin America, because it was reproduced during the colony, as post-colonial studies have demonstrated. Later, it was replicated by criollo elites, as we can see, for example, in the Constitution of Latin America, new countries after the independence, as for example, Ansaldi, amongst others, has outlined it. The emancipatory processes did not break this rate of exclusion. We may ask ourselves if revolutions for independence were passive revolutions or political revolutions, but certainly they were not really social revolutions. In any case, it is fair to remember that this marginalized project for inclusive political humanism of which I spoke before, also repressed, remained latent in the left, and left its inheritance in intellectual heterodoxy and in political and religious resistance, both in Spain and Latin America. Again, Spinoza, theology of liberation, etc. For sure, it did not remain, as I am arguing, in the political practices of criollismo. Still today, criollo elites in cohabitation with economic powers lead governments in the majority of Latin America countries and keep reproducing this exclusion rationality. And just for ending, I want to talk about the consequences that of an implication of the fact of this practice of domination and exclusion is still alive in Latin America, both in the behavior of the powers and also inside the political subjectivities of the population, fixed around the self-perception as excluded, as not citizens is invited to the construction of the state, and that operates as a political inhibitor. Under the ratio I'm talking about, the state was in for the people not as a warrantor of rights, but seen as something external and only with a coercive attitude. Precisely, these facts have created a condition of distrust in government caused by the self-assumption of people as excluded, and that fortifies the authoritarian forms of state that neoliberalism masks, and led to the impossibility of the construction of a community that could become a political community by hand on the state, could be out of state. The political community can only be developed in parallel to the state, which besides usually is corrupt, perpetrator of social and economic asymmetries, repressor, and even fratricidal. For example, there are sadly a lot of examples for that. For example, Mexico, where we came from, Ayotzinapa. Well, and to finish, I'm sorry for the time, just mention that maybe the results are positive in this aspect of in that distancing from the state consequence of this ratio of exclusion. I will explain myself. Insofar as people has not introjected the hegemonic liberal idea of citizenship, the social struggles are articulated in at margin of the state in social movements, and this is a good prevention against their cooptation by the system and the subsequent neutralization of their critical strength and their potential to build new paradigm, because unfortunately also some crucial movements in the latest years have been co-opted. Only if the social struggles avoid these risks, the struggles could be able to take the institution, as Laclau theory of left populism suggests. And only that way a true republicanism might be carried out, achieving a more solid antagonistic stances against the demands of authoritarianism. Sorry.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.